coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Christina School District continues to check all the boxes as it moves to implement its agreement with the state to reorganize its Wilmington schools. But there are still potential pitfalls on the way to the finish line.
While I'm hearing words of confidence, I suspect that some of the people making those assertions are speaking with their fingers crossed behind their backs.
Contributor Larry Nagguest looks at what issues remain in this latest effort to improve schools in the state's largest city. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also learn more about the impact the lack of Medicaid coverage for adult dental care in the first aid is having on some people. And we bring you the latest episode of the A Matter of Facts podcast, looking at what we know and maybe should know about artificial intelligence. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Before the start of the current school year last August, contributor Larry Nagengast took an in-depth look at the progress being made toward implementing the Memorandum of Understanding between the state of Delaware and the Christina School District that will reorganize Christina's schools in the city of Wilmington. At the time, Larry reported that most of the early milestones in the memorandum's timeline were met, but there was still a great deal of hard work remaining. Now, a year after the agreement took effect and the current school year heading into its final months, are things still on track? Larry Nagengast recently revisited the memorandum timeline to see where things stand. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to offer an update on this story. So let's start with the big picture question. Since you last updated us at the start of this school year, generally speaking, how well has implementing the Memorandum of Understanding gone?
Well, okay, I think your big picture question here is probably going to be the easiest one you're going to ask me. A lot of the big planning issues have been resolved relatively smoothly. Essentially, here's what's going on. Two of the Christina District's elementary schools in Wilmington will be closed in June. Then in August, there are going to be two schools, Bancroft and Byard, that will be serving grades 1 through 8, and a third school, Stubbs, serving pre-kindergarten and kindergarten. The new attendance lines have been drawn, and the students have been told which schools they will be attending. There's been a new school calendar developed. It's added 15 days to the school year and extra days on top of that built in for professional development for staff members. All of that's been approved. The leadership teams for all three schools have been named. So these are all very significant steps forward.
When you last looked at this, the Memorandum of Understanding between Christina's Teachers Union and the district was still up in the air. That did get worked out. What does it do for the teachers, and where does the district stand with staffing for its new school configuration as we're moving forward?
Well, again, this is a piece that looks pretty good right now. The MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding with the Teachers Union, contains multiple incentives for teaching in city schools. There's a $4,000 bonus that teachers receive for making a two-year commitment. They get extra money for classroom supplies. There are additional funds being made available to them for tuition reimbursements for graduate school classes, that sort of thing. And they've also gotten, this is very important, protection against any layoffs following this school year and the following next school year, the 2019-2020 school year. Now, that package overall was attractive enough that 113 teachers requested assignments to the city schools. 92 of those teachers were given positions at the school that was the first choice among the three that they wanted. So you've got 113 teachers already in positions. 92 of them are where they really wanted to be. Now this leaves 36 openings, according to Christina Superintendent Rick Gregg. 36 may seem to be a fairly high number, but you know, as far as he's concerned, that's a really good place to be in March.
Well, like the last time we talked about this whole process, your piece this time suggests that there's no time for Christina and the state to rest on these bits of good news that you've just told us about. There are still issues to address. Let's try to hit them one by one here. First, the buildings affected by this reorganization plan need work. How much work? How long is this going to take?
Okay. Now, because of these changed grade configurations, all three of these schools will need substantial renovations. For example, classrooms that were originally built in a middle school like Byard to serve eighth graders aren't necessarily going to work well for kids who are first and second grade students. And then there are these security issues as well. I mean, not only the heightened security that goes into just about every school renovation these days, but also in planning ways to separate the grade levels. They've got first and second on one floor, third through fifth on another, sixth through eighth on the upper floor. So what they're doing is they're designing patterns. They'll, you know, keep the big kids out of the first grade areas and keep the first graders from being able to wander up onto the third floor where the eighth graders are. And, the concerns that you've got here, Bancroft and Byard, are kind of similar. School configurations are certainly different now, but they are both going to become one through eight buildings. Over at Stubbs, it's a little bit different. Much of the renovation there involves transforming the upper level of the school, which had been serving grades 3 through 5, into what's being called this dual generation center. That's a place where there are going to be offices and open spaces and the like, where parents and community members are going to be able to come in and to look for jobs, to receive counseling, attend workshops, and so on. So, essentially, you're taking the top floor of an elementary school and turning it from classrooms into a space that's going to be primarily used by adults. Now, we've got a budget of $17.5 million for these projects at all three schools. $15 million comes from the state, and the rest comes from the Christina District. But the architects still haven't given the district final cost estimates on the projects at each of these buildings. So it's not really clear whether the money that's available is going to cover everything that the state and the district want in the buildings. Now, on top of that, the work can't start until school ends in June. With this new longer school year, teachers go back to work in the Wilmington schools on August 5th. Students start classes on August 12th. So they're acknowledging, I mean, there's no way that all of this construction work is going to get done on time. So, and again, the timeline isn't really firm yet. So some of these students are not going to be in their regular classrooms at the start of the school year. Eventually, they will be moving into them, but we're really not quite sure when. So some of the kids are going to be right where they're supposed to be at the start of the school year. Some of them are going to be moving around a little bit. And there's a lot of uncertainty there.
Another big piece of this plan is adding the wraparound services that have been promised that you alluded to. Where does that stand?
Okay. Again, the MOU calls for development of a series of wraparound services. These are things like health centers in the schools, mental health counseling, expanded before and after school programming, things like that that would benefit students and their families as well. Now, this programming requires a lot of collaboration among other state agencies and with nonprofits. You know, we're talking about groups like United Way, Children's and Families First, Boys and Girls Clubs, other social service agencies. Now, the state is putting up $1.5 million for this programming. As with the construction issue, it's not clear how much that money is going to buy. Now, in case the $1.5 million is not enough, the state says it's going to be asking foundations for grants to support these initiatives. More significantly, as with the construction, none of these agreements have been signed yet, so there's much more work to be done, resolving who does what and ironing out the details associated with the programming. Now, with the number of partnerships between schools and social service agencies growing over the years, that's helpful because the schools are somewhat familiar with this sort of thing. But in this instance, some of the level of planning involves moving into what really amounts to virgin territory. Putting these pieces together is in many respects much more difficult than it was doing things like redrawing attendance lines.
And on top of those two issues and the associated uncertainty, there are a couple of wild cards now. The first appears to be somewhat minor. That's the state's point person on this effort. Darrell Green has left his job as head of the Department of Education's Office of Innovation and Improvement to become, as we've reported, superintendent in the Red Clay School District. What impact, if any, could Darrell Green's move have on this whole process?
Well, I don't know if you can call this one a minor issue. To maintain the momentum in all this implementation of the planning, it's important that Green's job be filled promptly and with a manager who is strong and respected. However, applications for the position can still be filed through Saturday, March 23. And then comes screening and interviews. So the job is likely to be vacant for a couple of weeks, more likely for about another month. Now, a group of Department of Education managers will be sharing the load in the meantime, but Green had an incredible network of connections, and he had built a great reservoir of goodwill that will be hard to replace. To have him leave when there's so much to do in completing arrangements for all these wraparound services is a little bit unsettling. Now, on the other hand, you know, and it's good to be able to say this, it's not like Durrell Green has left the state. He's right next door to Christina. He's in the Red Clay School District. It's not going to be a tough job for Christina Superintendent Rick Gregg to pick up the phone and give him a call. And, you know, and Gregg's certainly not going to be reluctant to do that. But I have heard also some concern about Green's successor. And I realize, you know, the applications are still coming in. But, you know, he was the ideal choice for this job in the first place. He's a strong leader. He was familiar with Christina from having worked there before, having also worked in the Brandywine School District. He knew a good deal about the city of Wilmington. So, you know, the caliber of his replacement will be seen by some people as an indication of the strength and of the depth of Governor Carney's commitment to genuinely improve schools in Wilmington.
The much bigger wild card, not surprisingly, has to do with money. Christina has a tax referendum vote coming up at the end of April. Tell us a little bit about what the district's looking for, and probably more importantly, if it fails, what are the implications for the city reorganization and Christina as a whole?
Well, you know, this is a really, really interesting situation. You know, the referendum isn't directly tied to the Wilmington Schools reorganization. That reorganization is going to be carried out no matter what. However, the district is looking for a 34-cent tax increase over 3 years. If approved, the typical house in the district, one that has an assessed value of $64,100, would see a tax hike of $218 by the third year. That's about $18 a month. However, if the referendum fails, it will have serious implications for the suburban portion of the district and for the teachers who work there. Here's why. The MOU that we talked about between Christina and the state spells out numerous improvements for Wilmington schools. And the MOU between Christina and its teachers gives those teachers assigned to those schools in Wilmington 2 years of protection against layoffs. Now, generally, when referendums fail, one likely outcome is budget cuts. And that means that some teachers are going to lose their jobs. And generally, in most other situations, those cuts tend to be spread throughout a school district. But the situation in Christina this year could be different because that MOU appears to insulate Wilmington schools and Wilmington teachers. And that means that the impact of any cuts will fall disproportionately on schools and teachers in the suburban portion of the Christina district. As you know, Tom, Christina is one of the few, very few, non-contiguous school districts in the country. And some of the resentment that began with desegregation in 1978 still smolders in that suburban part of the district. Busing, at least from the suburbs to the city, has pretty much gone away. But there are still some suburban residents in the Christina district who blame low-income kids from the city for the district's overall low performance in the state's annual school testing program. So there's a potential here for a lot of discontent if the referendum fails, from families in suburban schools who might endure the bulk of the budget cuts, and from teachers in those schools who would have a greater risk of losing their jobs. Needless to say, successful passage of the referendum could prevent a lot of problems from developing, but the history of school referendum votes in Christina and throughout Delaware is that the district usually fails to get what it asks for the first time around.
And with all those potential pitfalls still lurking out there, especially that last one, how confident is the Carney administration and the district now that this is going to get done and have the level of impact they want it to have on Wilmington schools?
Well, at the state level, right now anyway, there are no alarm bells ringing. When I asked the Department of Education about some of these issues, the response I received included phrases like, "The state continues to work with the district, and we will coordinate resources with the other state agencies to integrate services." In other words, we're working on it, and we expect to get it done. Now, when I spoke to Christina Superintendent Rick Gregg, he wasn't too concerned about students being moved from one part of one school to another while construction is underway. He thinks that's manageable. But when I asked him about the possible implications of a failed referendum, there was a long pause, like this, before he started to answer. I think Rick Gregg has confidence in his staff, but he's aware that potholes lurk in the road ahead. While I'm hearing words of confidence, I suspect that some of the people making those assertions are speaking with their fingers crossed behind their backs. And finally, let's keep the really big picture in mind here. Governor Carney's plan to improve Christina schools in Wilmington was at first seen as a lesser version of a plan promoted by former Governor Jack Markell. And that plan wasn't nearly as comprehensive as what was recommended by the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission. So, whatever we get in August as a result of this effort, and to be fair, it really has been quite an effort, it's still only a first step toward giving Wilmington students the educational opportunities that they're going to need to succeed.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. You can find his piece on the progress being made on implementing the plan to reorganize the Christina School District's Wilmington schools right now online at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we learn more about what the lack of Medicaid coverage for adult dental care in Delaware means to some here in the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks to Delaware's 2014 Medicaid expansion, tens of thousands of low-income adults in the first state were able to access preventive medical services. But one piece was missing: dental coverage. And as Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller reports, the lack of affordable dental coverage results in real cost to people's health and finances, and to the state.
Very big cavity.
A few years ago, Bear resident Jessica Favaccia was struggling to find a dentist for her mother, Janice, who has Alzheimer's disease and lives in a nursing home. Janice has Medicaid, which doesn't cover dental care. Jessica says the few clinics in Delaware that offer low-income dental services had long waits. But then Jessica says her mom fell and cracked her teeth.
Definitely caused her pain. And you can see that she's now, even still, she has very sensitive teeth, so cold drinks and things like that, she winces, and so she still has pain.
The federal government leaves it up to states to decide whether they'll offer dental services for those on Medicaid. Delaware opts not to offer dental coverage. AmeriHealth has a Medicaid plan that offers dental, but that benefit only helps 957 Delawareans. Poor oral health can take a toll financially and on a person's health. Data from the Center for Healthcare Strategies shows Delaware and just two other states, Tennessee and Alabama, don't provide dental coverage for low-income adults. Delaware's decision impacts about 146,790 adults on Medicaid. There's a small number of places in the first state that offer reduced prices for dental services. Laredo Health Center, Henrietta Johnson Medical Center, and Westside Family Health Care have a sliding scale. Delaware Tech has a fee schedule for procedures, and Nemours offers dental services for low-income seniors. Christiana Care Health System has an emergency clinic and an oral surgery residency program that accepts uninsured Medicaid and Medicare. Jessica's mother, Janice, went to Christiana Care's emergency clinic for her cracked teeth and got established as a regular patient. But aides at the nursing home struggled to get her to let them brush her teeth. And Jessica says she continues to experience problems.
She's had issues with those cracked teeth, and she's been to the clinic for those and had teeth extracted because of it. She's also had really severe damage to her back teeth just over time, wear and tear, and not proper care of them. And so she's had those extracted and just recently had what looked like gravel in the back of her mouth. It was just like her root tips were exposed, and it was just that, so they pulled those.
Dan Mira chairs Christiana Care's program. He says untreated dental problems can cause infections and abscesses in the face, neck, and jaw areas. Some patients can spend days in intensive care or even die.
They can cause significant swelling, which affects the ability for the patient to breathe and swallow. So that all of a sudden the patient's at home, they're not drinking very well. They start to complain that their breathing's not as good, and then they present to the emergency department.
Mira says the tens of thousands of surgeries they do every year could be prevented by something as simple as getting a cavity filled. But when you don't have the means to get preventive care, nothing about it is simple. Najali Abrigo has been a patient at Westside for more than 10 years. The 36-year-old Newcastle resident is paying $50 on this day to get a cavity filled. Abrigo says she's had it since last October, but she lost her job and couldn't afford the copay. Because she speaks limited English, a Westside staffer translated her response to questions.
Sería mucho mejor.
It would be much better if Medicaid did cover it, because she had to stop coming for a little bit because of the payment. She didn't have the payment enough, but if Medicaid would have covered it, she would have been able to come to her visits.
Megan Werner is Associate Medical Director for Westside. She argues preventive oral care lowers the risk of complications to vulnerable populations like pregnant women.
So when you don't have good oral health care, you wind up getting a lot of bacteria in your mouth that then contribute to inflammation in your gums. And it's thought that that chronic inflammation and that load of bacteria contributes to the preterm delivery and the low birth weight.
Werner adds that people with chronic diseases like diabetes who neglect their mouth can make their health conditions worse.
It can increase your risk of heart attacks and strokes. People can have complications in the small blood vessels in their eyes and lose their vision, in the small blood vessels in their kidneys, and wind up with chronic kidney disease.
Oral surgeries at Christiana and treating more severe chronic conditions because of poor oral health can cost pretty much everybody. The federal government, the state, hospitals, and families. Mira and Werner argue Delaware would save money if it funded preventive coverage through Medicaid. About a dozen states, including Maryland, only offer emergency dental services, with about six states giving emergency care to their expanded Medicaid population. But Maryland is starting a pilot program next month to cover low-income adults on Medicaid after doing an analysis on how much it was costing them. That analysis, done with the American Dental Association, found there were more than 42,000 ER visits for chronic dental conditions between 2013 and 2016. The average cost of those visits was $446. The Delaware Department of Health and Social Services was unable to provide similar information for the state. Mary Backley is the executive director of the Maryland Dental Action Coalition. She says Medicaid was being billed nearly $10 million for those Maryland ER visits, costing the state money. But she says the underlying issues were also not being addressed.
And what we think is also going to happen is that it may also have an impact on other areas of overall health. And I refer back to my systemic correlation with, you know, diabetes and other aspects. And we think what's going to happen is that it will also reduce costs affiliated for care of acute cases.
Christiana Care found that for fiscal year 2012, it saw 3,900 ER visits with an average cost of $480 a visit. Those visits totaled nearly $2 million that year. About 53% of the patients had Medicaid and 25% had no insurance. In 2014, Delaware expanded Medicaid, adding about 68,000 adults to the rolls. Former State Senator Bethany Hall Long, now Lieutenant Governor, sponsored legislation in 2015 providing dental coverage for pregnant women. The fiscal note estimated the bill would help more than 2,500 women at a cost of $1.68 million over 3 years. Hall Long also sponsored a bill in 2015 to give nearly 117,000 uninsured adults on Medicaid dental benefits. It was estimated to cost about $4.3 million in fiscal year 2015 and $7.39 million in FY 2016 and 2017, but neither bill had enough support to pass the General Assembly. Governor John Carney, like previous Delaware governors, is not recommending expanding Medicaid dental coverage for low-income adults. He says he's unaware of the benefits of preventive services.
But it makes sense that obviously we do what we can to make sure that as many Delawareans, all Delawareans, have comprehensive health care services.
The U.S. Surgeon General is working on a national oral health report due out next year. A health policy expert with the American Dental Association says he believes it will partly focus on the economic cost of not providing dental coverage. About 44% of low-income adults in Delaware say the condition of their teeth affects their ability to interview for a job. He says that percentage is one of the highest of any state. Jessica Favaccia says she remains worried her mother's poor oral health could lead to other health complications.
I know that there is a correlation between, you know, cardiac health and dental care. So that's why you would think that Medicaid would cover it, because they want to be proactive, prophylactic, and, you know, take care of these things before they're an issue. But that's just me, I guess.
Najali Obrego and other Medicaid patients say they hope Delaware starts covering dental services for adults. Sarah Mueller, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And stay with us. The Green continues with the latest edition of the A Matter of Fact podcast and an exploration of artificial intelligence. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has created a podcast, A Matter of Facts, to delve into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of its mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. Delaware Public Media is proud to help produce this podcast, and we also thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative, and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And this week on The Green, we bring you the latest episode of A Matter of Facts. Artificial intelligence is a term we're all pretty familiar with, but how much do we really know about it, beyond the way it's portrayed in pop culture and science fiction through movies, TV shows, books, and the like? What is the state of AI right now, and where is it headed? What does AI mean to you and me, both now and in the future? These questions have both practical and philosophical implications, and we want to try to sort through some of that in this episode. And to do that, we welcome Dr. Susan Schneider, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Cognitive Science at the University of Connecticut and Director of the AI Mind and Society Group there. She's a distinguished scholar at the Library of Congress and recipient of the National Endowment for the Humanities Public Scholar Award. She's also author of the book, The Language of Thought, A New Philosophical Direction, and has a new book coming this fall, Artificial You, AI, and the Future of Your Mind. Dr. Susan Schneider, thanks for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So let's start here. How far apart are the depiction of AI that the average person may be familiar with and the reality of AI today? Is it a big gap?
Yes and no. So people tend to think of AI in terms of robots. So they're thinking of androids that they may see on TV, like Sophia, for example, with Hanson Robotics. And they may be thinking that the capacities of these androids from an intellectual standpoint is quite impressive. But in reality, the physical androids are actually just being developed as physical duplicates of humans. And they still require an inbuilt artificial intelligence component. So I think the public tends to get science fiction-like very quickly because of these examples of AI. But in reality, AI is, in a sense, all around us. I mean, it's there when you're doing a Google search. It's there beating the world Go and Jeopardy champions. It may not be what people think of, though, when they're thinking of artificial intelligence.
Are there some common misconceptions about AI, kind of beyond that, thinking it's an Android piece of it?
Yeah, there are a lot of common misconceptions. I mean, so I think one thing to call people's attention to is what the historian Michael Best calls the Jetsons fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of the future, you probably think of a future where robots are serving us and we have a smart house all wired in via the Internet of Things. But people don't realize that AI will actually be inside the brain. So it will be potentially changing our ability to think. We may have things like mobile internet connections hooking up directly to the brain. We may have brain chips devoted to enhancing our abilities to, say, calculate or remember. So these are the kind of things people aren't necessarily seeing as being potentially in their future and their children's future, but it's definitely work in progress. So Google and Facebook have both been developing these technologies, as has the military and a company called Kernel.
Just hearing that, I realize there's a lot to unpack when you talk about artificial intelligence, and probably not enough time to do it justice within one episode of this podcast. So let me take this direction with it and say, what are some of the key points about AI that you try to drive home with people regarding where it is now, where it's headed, and its implications? I know you kind of alluded to some of it there. Are there some things when you know, people say, well, tell me what I need to know about AI right now, whereas I'm starting to maybe try to learn about it? What are kind of the key things that you emphasize with people?
Well, I hope people bear in mind that AI regulation is currently the Wild West. So we've seen some amazing innovations, and we're not quite ready to handle them socially. An example of this is the scandals with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, in which our data was sold and the data of our contacts. So, you know, it's the failure of AI regulation that worries me primarily. So that's one issue. Another issue is because of the rapid fire innovations in the domain of AI, most employment experts agree that there will probably be massive technological unemployment or underemployment caused by artificial intelligence. So in other words, we humans will be outmoded. This, in turn, could put a lot of pressure on humans to enhance their own brains as a result. So that's a lot to think about. what do we do? You know, when virtually all professions could be outmoded. I mean, if you think about just self-driving cars, for example.
Right.
In 10 years, that could mean that there is not a need for drivers any longer. Of course, you can debate the time frame. But I think 1/8 of all employed people are actually in driving professions right now. So that's sort of mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're already there's already work on AI attorneys, which may be a good thing, right? Let's get rid of them. No, I'm just kidding. My husband's an attorney. But, I mean, you know, it's going to apply across the board to professors like myself.
Well, even journalists. I mean, I know there are AI programs that they have, like, writing sports stories that could take, like, the basic information of, like, a basketball game from the box score and are trying to, like, write stories instead of a sports writer.
Absolutely. I think we're all up for replacement. And, you know, that raises, you know, back to government reaction. You know, it raises issues of maybe there should be something like a universal basic income where everybody receives a minimum amount. And that, you know, it's politically very controversial, but it would seem like both sides of the aisle will have to do something about massive technological unemployment. I mean, it won't be able to ignore it. And I think we should begin the discussion now, because the data is strongly supportive of technological unemployment. And similarly, you know, if you have a child that is entering college, I mean, it's important that people think about what areas will not be affected by AI, you know, over the next 10 years, and they plan accordingly. I mean, it's hard to suggest anything besides a good, broad-ranging education.
You mentioned the regulation piece and the government role, and President Trump signed an executive order last month asking the federal government's agencies to dedicate more resources, investment in the research, promotion, training in artificial intelligence. Kind of a broad statement, no specific funding attached. Is that the kind of start we need, or do you need something a little bit more specific than that? You know, how do you see that as, you know, a starting point for maybe addressing what you were just talking about?
I think it's a good starting point. And obviously there will be funds allocated and decisions made about how to do so. We absolutely have to start preparing for AI being at the very center of our future. And we also need to think of strategic issues, you know, our relation with China, you know, maintaining strength in artificial intelligence, very important.
I want to talk a little bit about reporting on AI, and I can say as a news director, reporting on science and technology can be very difficult for many news organizations, trying to translate complex science ideas into digestible, understandable news stories. From your standpoint, how do journalists do reporting on AI? Are they helping or hindering people's understanding at this point?
Well, I love working with journalists. I've had some amazing experiences. So I actually confess I write pieces for Scientific American and the New York Times. So I'm sort of, you know, a journalist myself,
in that realm,
I suppose.
Yes.
I do see cultural misunderstandings filtering into science journalism for sure. So one thing that disturbs me is a sort of techno-optimism and enthusiasm for anything tech gurus say. So, you know, if Elon Musk says it, wow. You know, and it's not that, I mean, he's a very smart man, and hey, you know, I love my Tesla. Thank you, Elon, right? But, I mean, look, I mean, the future of the mind, for example, or this, you know, we're talking about artificial intelligence, we're talking about putting it in the head, we're talking about creating robots that, you know, we may think of as people. And, you know, these are actually philosophical issues, too, and it's not something that businesses like Google and Facebook should be regarded by the public as being authorities about. I mean, you know, I think that these are social decisions. So, for example, to go back to the idea of how AI is moving inside the head, that's been something that Musk has been a big proponent of. He thinks that we need to enhance our own brains. And he started a company, Neuralink, to develop technology to enhance the brain. And he says we need to do this to keep up with AI and avoid technological unemployment. We're tinkering with the mind, and this really involves the future of our children and grandchildren, you know, subsequent generations, maybe even us. So just because a tech leader says it doesn't mean, you know, it's inevitable. I think we just need to have cultural dialogue on these issues. I think the media is wonderful in inspiring cultural dialogue.
Well, you've kind of taken me right where I wanted to go, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was the fact that you know, AI can be even more complicated for journalists to cover and people in general to discuss because, as you mentioned, it has this philosophical element to it, the consciousness, self-awareness. You write and lecture a lot on AI becoming conscious, and your upcoming book, Artificial You, is described as a sober-minded philosophical exploration of what AI can and cannot achieve. With all that in mind, tell us a little bit more about what this may look like, what we should be keeping in mind as we look toward that future and what its implications are.
Yeah. So part of the book is on this idea of enhancing the brain through AI technology and asking whether we could truly merge with AI. And I urge that we have to consider the underlying philosophical issues about what we are, what is the mind, because otherwise we're enhancing the brain in radical ways, and who knows? I mean, at the end of the day, we may not even be the same person in any way, shape, or form. Like, how do we want to move forward with altering our own minds? Relatedly, the book talks about the possibility of machine consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I think there are a lot of cultural misunderstandings. I mean, I think there's a tendency, again, to go back to this kind of techno-optimist perspective that you see in the media and in the public, especially the techie public, this idea that if it's a sophisticated artificial intelligence, if it, you know, is what we might call artificial general intelligence, which is something that we haven't developed yet, but I think we're inching, you know, with every passing year, every passing decade, we, I believe, are moving closer in the direction of general intelligences that have intellectual capacities that rival at least non-human animals and maybe eventually human intelligence. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we develop these things, there's this assumption that these creatures will be conscious, that it will feel like something to be them. And that's because in the biological world, the sophisticated cognizers are conscious. But I urge that we have to be very careful making that kind of assumption for a variety of reasons. We just don't know whether other substrates will even be capable of having experience. I mean, just because something is a sophisticated information processing device, it doesn't follow that it feels like anything to be it.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, these things, they will look human in many cases. So that's going to be unnerving for the public. I mean, if you look at, for example, the kind of work that's already going on in Japan to create androids to take care of the elderly, these creatures from a distance look extremely human.
And I wonder if this is kind of an interesting part of the conversation as well, and the fact that it is this part of the conversation sometimes a barrier to people understanding AI and its implications, because it is so complicated and it delves into some really basic philosophical issues that some people are just like, I just don't want to, that's too deep. I can't think about that. Is that a barrier to people kind of engaging on this topic, because it just seems like, wow, that is just way too much for me?
And I think that's why philosophers in particular have to write for the public and engage with the public and use examples that hammer points home, because we have a moral obligation to do that. If we just write for each other in a technical vocabulary, then the public and the policymakers may not understand these crucial issues involving the self and the mind that impact emerging technologies.
In addition to your upcoming book that we've talked about, Artificial You, you also have a National Endowment for the Humanities Project, Future Minds, Artificial Intelligence, Brain Enhancement, and the Nature of Self. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's all about?
Oh, yeah. So I just retitled the book. It was going to be called Future Minds.
Okay, so
The next book, the one that I'm writing right now at the Library of Congress, in fact, I'm their distinguished scholar. I'm having a great time here. I'm calling you from the library right now. It's called The Future of Intelligence.
Okay.
And so what it's doing is talking about whether we humans could enhance our brains and maintain parity with artificial intelligence, and where we will stand in relation to other creatures in the universe, should they exist. So part of my work is with NASA, where I think about the evolution of intelligence in the universe and the possible types of life we might encounter. So what I'm doing is really pulling it all together, talking about the space of possible intelligences and seeing where we humans will fare and what we can, and how much we can enhance the brain. And I do think we might have limitations or design ceilings on our own enhancement. sadly. So if you're looking to, you know, transfer all of your mental capacities to the cloud or upload your brain or something like that to avoid death, you know, to go back to techno-optimism.
Yep.
Right. I think that's taking it too far. Not sure that it would be feasible.
And you've also talked a little bit about what type of intelligence we could find if we kind of reach out into space seeking other intelligent life, and that we may not encounter biological intelligent life, but this kind of artificial, synthetic intelligent life.
Yes. So I love that stuff. I love thinking about it. So here's one thing I always tell people. I'm not suggesting that the first life we find, should we find life, would be intelligent. I think it will be microbial.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be far, you know, there'll be more cases of that in the universe than intelligent life. But what I was looking at, my project for NASA, was what would the most intelligent beings in the universe be? And my answer was, the most intelligent ones will have enhanced themselves. They will be synthetic, and they probably won't be biological anymore, because other substrates, like silicon, for example, they can outperform us, and they're far more durable. And similarly, in the context of space flight, I mean, it's a big universe. It's an 8-year round trip just for information to flow here, from here to Alpha Centauri and back, which is the nearest star. So think about the vast interstellar distances, and how are we going to send a biological entity? So similarly, if we encounter something that's, you know, traveling here, it's probably going to be synthetic.
It's fascinating. It really is.
It's a trip.
and the implications for, like, what that means with how they would interact perhaps potentially with us as biological life forms is a fascinating possibility as well.
Right, exactly. Like, what are we searching for when we're searching for intelligence in the universe? I mean, it's very difficult to think about this, because a civilization could be something like 50,000 years older than us, and it will be super intelligent relative to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't enhanced our own brains yet in any radical ways. We don't have super intelligent artificial intelligence yet, so how do we know what we're looking for? My own suspicion is, if other creatures are out there that are at that level of intelligence, we won't really know how to look for them until we turn on our super intelligent systems, either in the form of AIs or in the form of enhanced humans.
Fascinating. If people are interested in delving deeper into this topic, what resources do you recommend that they go to?
Well, I had a piece in Nautilus on this that's very accessible. I like writing for, you know, science publications that are available to the public. And then the book has a chapter on this topic, a book called Artificial You.
Mm-hmm.
If you turn to the season finale of Star Talk, which is the Neil deGrasse Tyson show, I think it's airing in a couple months. I'm starring in it together with Teddy from Westworld. And so we're talking about all this there, and it turned out to be a very accessible episode. I also strongly recommend reading Martin Rees, The Royal Astronomer. All his books are just so wonderful. Max Tegmark has a really cool book called, I believe it's called Life 3.0, on a lot of these questions. And then the philosopher David Chalmers, wonderfully accessible. I strongly recommend reading his books as well.
And we'd like to end this podcast by asking each of our guests the same question, which is, where do you get your news on a daily basis, your everyday news? What are your favorite news sources?
Well, I love NPR. I love it. I really enjoy the New York Times. For AI stuff, I like Wired. all kinds of places. I mean, I appreciate Nautilus. You know, I appreciate quality science journalism.
Well, Dr. Susan Schneider, we really appreciate your time. Dr. Susan Schneider is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Cognitive Science at the University of Connecticut and also currently a Distinguished Scholar at the Library of Congress, where she is speaking to us from today. Dr. Schneider, thank you so much for being with us on the Matter of Facts podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, A Matter of Facts podcast guest Dr. Susan Schneider, and Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.